Welcome to Well-Versed, where we bring biblical principles of governance to governmental leaders and you. This is the Well-Versed Podcast.
Well, we welcome you to this Well-Versed Podcast, and today's guest is Rick Green. Some of our guests recently have been from either Israel or Texas. We're kind of landing on those two places, but I am so excited to introduce Rick. I met him a number of years ago and blown away. He's an explosion of information and an absolute delight. Rick, welcome to the Well-Versed Podcast.
Well, it's no accident that you're having a lot of people from Israel and Texas. That's the two promised lands.
I knew I teed it up for you.
You set yourself up for that one, brother.
As soon as I said that, I said, this is gonna go somewhere. Okay. Well, I can't. Having lived in Texas in the past, I love that state, and I have to agree, it's a pretty wonderful place. Okay, you were born where?
I have to admit, I was born in a neighboring state. I was born in Arkansas as a kid, but I grew up in Dallas, and then ended up at the University of Texas Law School down in Austin, and been in Texas since I was 9. So I'm an American by birth and a Texan only by the grace of God.
And are you an attorney as well?
Yeah, I was afraid you might kick me off the show if I admitted it, but yeah, yes, sir.
So how did you get into what you're currently doing? Because you run these big Patriot Academies, you do some amazing stuff. How'd you get from being a lawyer into this?
You know, I served in the Texas legislature at a very young age. I was 26 when I ran for office and ended up winning and served in the House for a couple
what?
Terms. And
what's this? You were 26 when you were state legislator?
Yeah, I was too young, honestly, but it was
were you the youngest in America?
No, there was one guy in Texas that was 2 years younger than me. He's actually Speaker of the House in Texas right now, but he was 2 years younger than me at the time. And it was actually, I'll tell you that you'll like this, Jim. I had on election night, 30,000 people voted in my race, and I lost by 20 votes.
Oh.
And then we had a recount, and I won by 36 votes after the recount. And that was in 1998, before anybody knew what a Florida recount was in a presidential race or any of that. So I did get a great call from the governor after the recount that night. And he said, Rick, I'm officially dubbing you Landslide Green. And that was George W. Bush that did that. And 2 years later, he had his own recount.
Oh, my goodness. That is amazing. So you served in the legislature how long?
Served for 2 terms. And it was actually while I was in the legislature. I had kind of grown up, not grown up, but since I was in my days in law school, been listening to David Barton. Somebody had given me a cassette tape for those that you and I remember those, but some of our listeners may not, but of David Barton, and history came to life for me for the first time. I fell in love with it. So when I got in the legislature, David was willing to kind of advise me when I call him on different items, and then started going out and speaking for him and filling in for him when he couldn't go, and just had the wonderful privilege of learning at his feet for the last 20 years. So I started hosting his radio program and just really been blessed to be with the Bartons for a long time. And that's kind of what took us into even doing the Patriot Academy is a mock legislative session. And what we do is we put young people in that arena, 16 to 25, when they're kind of figuring out what their worldview is, cementing what do I believe, not just mom and dad. And at that time, putting them in that situation where we can teach them biblical worldview and constitutional governance and raise them to be patriots for the next generation.
Wow. Rewind that for a moment. You're taking 16 to 25 year olds and you put them, it's called Patriot Academy. What's
yes,
the website for that, by the way?
PatriotAcademy.com. PatriotAcademy.com.
So you put them in an environment as if they're in a legislative session.
That's right.
And they bring
their own bills. You know, they can bring a bill on any subject they want. And they actually, you know, honestly, Jim, this is no exaggeration. It is so much like a real legislative session. Every year, people will come to visit the Capitol and they'll come down and talk to us. And they'll say, man, your legislators are really young in Texas. I mean, I just came because it sounds exactly like the real session. They think it's the real session. And we actually have real life reps that get elected in the primary that'll come spend Patriot Academy in the summer with us in order to practice so that they are, you know, have the system down when they show up in January. So it's very real.
Where do you hold this? Where do you?
We do it all over the country, but always in a real state capitol. So we
in the Capitol building itself.
In the Capitol. So they're on the real House floor in the real committee room, speaking on the real microphones, debating each other. I wanted them to feel what I felt when I was in the House floor, and realize they can actually impact this system. This is not. You know, I was 16 the first time I saw the Capitol in Austin, and I was down in Austin playing in the state baseball tournament, and our coach took us over to the Capitol. And I just remember looking at the Capitol, and then when we went in, and thinking, this is a different breed. This is a, you know, these are the guys from the right side of the tracks. I'm from the wrong side of the tracks. I could never do anything like this or impact this world. That was my thinking. And I went home and I told my dad that, and he said, son, if God's called you to that and you put in the elbow grease and you work hard and he blesses you to do it, that can be you. Well, that was 10 years later that I went from doubt to destiny. I was on the floor making those decisions and pushing that button on the House floor. And I want these kids every year to feel the same thing, to actually sit in that chair and go, I could do this. I could impact this world. And even if they don't run for office, which most of our graduates don't run, we've got graduates serving in state legislatures across the country. But most of our graduates, they go into business and entertainment. They make movies, they're doing music, but they've learned to be a good citizen, and they've learned that that political world answers to us, not the other way around, and that they can impact it.
How many people, how many years have you been doing it? How many students have gone through this so far?
We founded it literally 20 years ago when I was in the legislature, and I did it, Jim, out of frustration. I was watching all of the reps that claim to be conservative, and I'm Christian, I'm conservative, I'm constitutional. And then they're voting for price fixing and, you know, all these ridiculous things. And I called my dad from the House floor and I said, Dad, I'm just frustrated. This was 1999. I said, Dad, I'm just frustrated. I'm not changing minds. I just don't know if I should even be here. And my dad said to me in 1999, and you'll get this, he said, Rick, you need to do what Bill Clinton did. And I paused for a minute and I said, Dad, I'm not sure what you're talking about, but it doesn't sound like good advice to me. And he said, well, Bill Clinton had the governor school in Arkansas when he was governor, and he would bring in all the young best and brightest, all the leaders from the high schools and the colleges, and he would indoctrinate them with left-wing philosophy because they're the leaders of the next generation. He said, Rick, why can't you teach truth? Why can't you teach the Constitution, teach biblical worldview? I said, brilliant, we're going to do it. So we started that 20 years ago. We started with just, you know, a couple of dozen would come. Now we train about 500 young people a year in the actual academies and a several thousand more online and through our constitutional defense training and our other things we do. But it is, Jim, you'd love it. You ought to come hang out with, you ought to come speak to the kids. I'd love to have you. In fact, you got to do this. I'm going to put you on the spot on the air here. We do a charge just like they used to do. You've seen those that David Barton has in the library. Yeah. Where the legislature would come together and they would have a pastor come in and preach to them. We used to do that in all our state legislatures. We do that at Patriot Academy. We've done it for 20 years. At the first session, when they're taking the oath, we have a pastor come in and preach a charge to them and say, you're about to make law. You better know what the great lawgiver has to say about this. I'd love to have you do that. If you can't do it this year, next year, whatever. Jim, you'd be perfect for that.
Offer accepted.
All right.
No, I'd be honored. I'll be honored to be involved any way I could. I'm so thrilled and excited. You know, the first time we really got acquainted, we were flying on a plane and we were across the aisle from each other. Remember that?
That's exactly. I remember. I was thinking about it when I was getting ready for this. I was like, I wonder if Jim remembers when we sat on the plane. We weren't even next to each other. We were across the aisle from each other.
Yes.
And we had to keep, you know, the stewardess keep coming by. We talked the whole trip.
Yes. And I might point out, I was on the right and you were on the left. Don't let that bother you or anything.
But if we were on Zoom, it would have been a mirror image, and I would have been on the right now.
Oh, there we go.
Okay. And you know what's interesting? This is really interesting. You and I were actually supporting Newt Gingrich for president, and I thought it was interesting. Back when all this started in March, the same thing. I watched your podcast on this. The exact same thing happened to me. You didn't know this, but the exact same thing happened to me that happened to you. In just a period of about 24 hours, we saw all the Italy things happening, and Newt came out with his article about it. And I was thinking the exact same thing you were thinking, which you wrote about, and you said, that's a guy I respect. He usually is the smartest guy in the room. And he was saying, take note, we need to do something. And what's interesting is, Jim, we accomplished exactly what you said at the time to do and that Newt said at the time to do, and that is, hey, we're willing to make sacrifice to flatten the curve and make sure we don't end up like Italy. And we did that, and it worked. Exactly. But yet government still has its boot on our neck.
Okay, now that's exactly where you give me the segue to jump right in. I want to ask you this. You're a constitutional scholar. What authority does it have? Who has the authority? When do they have the authority? For how long do they have the authority? Walk me the who, what, when, how, all of that. Does the government have the authority to do what they're doing to us?
They don't have the authority to do what they're doing right now. They do have authority to do certain things and to intervene. And that's where we stopped asking the question of how far can they go We stopped asking which government, like which level of government, federal, state, local, and we stopped asking when is there a compelling interest? When is it bad enough? When is a disease bad enough that we want them to interact and intervene, if you will? And you know, we're not anti-government. Jim, and you and I both talk about this all the time. Government's a God-created institution. We're not against government doing its job. But when it gets outside of its boundaries, it's a curse instead of a blessing. When it's in its boundaries, it's a blessing. And so when it comes to something like a pandemic, there is a proper role for government. And let's just use the extreme example of, let's say a church has Ebola. Let's say that some people go on a mission trip and they come back with it, or a missionary shows up with it. And for whatever reason, it's in that church and it's starting to spread. We would all agree that government has a duty, the health, local health officials have the responsibility to prevent that disease that has a 50% case fatality rate, 25 to 90% in different cases, but the average is 50%. 50% of the people that get it are going to die and there's no cure. So we would all say, yeah, government should say, hey, you know what? For a couple of weeks, you guys need to not be meeting at this church. We're going to clean it
for a second. The U.S. Constitution speaks to this or does not speak to this issue specifically?
It does not specifically address pandemics. And it's not that the founding fathers hadn't dealt with that. You know, Benjamin Rush led the fight against yellow fever there in Philadelphia. They had dealt with smallpox, but they always believed that the only federal role was to prevent it from coming inside and in from outside, just like what Trump did when he shut down the travel from China. The founding fathers would have applauded that and said that's a proper role of the federal government. Everything else was left to the states and the local government to battle it and deal with it as they see fit, because everybody's different and the situation is going to be different in those areas. So
does
they
the
would have.
Constitution. So much I want to ask you here, man. Yeah. I wish we had about 3 days. does the Constitution talk specifically about blocking people from coming from the outside in a specific way?
Well, it would fall under the Article II powers of the president to protect the nation and to make sure that it's executing the orders that Congress has passed, and as commander-in-chief, making sure that those borders are safe and people aren't coming in with something that would be dangerous. They did not name pandemics. You can't find the word pandemic in the Constitution, but you would find them talking about it in speeches and letters back and forth. And then as you watch those first couple of decades after the Constitution, you can see states and local governments dealing with it and then look at what founding fathers said about it to get their view of whether or not it was constitutional. I think they would have very much been against, without question, they said so, they would have been against a federal involvement at the local level trying to solve those problems. And I think we have to applaud Trump for that. He has been unwilling to seize power the way that a lot of the leftists have asked him to. I mean, there's been a lot of left-leaning politicians begging the president to nationalize industry, to force a national lockdown, things that he would not apply in this circumstance. And his restraint has been fantastic.
And state constitutions, the power goes to the state, apparently. Individual state constitutions, do they speak specifically?
They do.
Of the language
they
of
do.
The pandemic? Okay.
Yeah, they do. Most state constitutions and statutes have all kinds of disaster statutes. Early 70s, most states adopted what they called like we have a Texas disaster statute that was adopted in 73 and 75, both. Most states have something like that. And then in the early 2000s, there was more movement across the country that kind of created some of these pandemic responses. But all of them dealt with the fact that if something had an outbreak, you had the power to deal with it in that area. So like using that church example, if that one church had an outbreak of Ebola, government would have the power to come in and say, we got to clean up this situation. We're going to quarantine the people that don't have Ebola, but they definitely had contact with someone that had Ebola. We're going to isolate. That's the correct term for if they have the disease, we're going to isolate them. Other people, they have no statutory authority to control their movements. That is something that's been created in the situation. They could keep them from going into that church if that church is the breeding ground until they have a chance to sanitize it. What they would not have ever done and did not do is say, oh, well, that church has it, so we're going to shut down every church in the state. That's what they've done with this situation. Or that church has it, we're going to shut down every church in the city. Constitutionally, what we would say is it's not a least restrictive or narrowly tailored intervention by government. What we've done now is we've done these broad strokes that I believe in the end the court is going to say, nope, you violated the idea of even if you had a compelling interest, which frankly, I think they no longer have one. They had one in March, they don't have one now. But even if you had a compelling interest, you're not implementing that in a least restrictive, narrowly tailored way. You're not going after the most vulnerable and just protecting them. By shutting down and stopping people.
Okay, you're, I'm sorry, I shouldn't.
Yeah.
Does have they ever quarantined everybody? We've all been quarantined. No. Or do they quarantine those who they know are ill?
That's right. It's a totally new thing in our history. You know, quarantine is for the sick or those that have come in contact with the sick. Isolation is for the sick. Quarantine is for those who have come in contact with the sick.
Oh, repeat that right there. That's critical.
Sure. Yeah. The two terms mean different things. Isolation is what you do if someone has been known to have the disease. We did that when Ebola came to Dallas a few years ago. Governor Perry, you know, had the health officials isolate the guy that came in from Liberia. He had Ebola, so we isolated him. And then we quarantined the people that he came in contact with. We didn't do a very good job of it, but we did all the people that he knew. We just didn't do that with the nurses, and that's how it started to spread a little bit. So that's the way it should be handled, right? You quarantine and you isolate. But if you're healthy, we would never say, in that case, perfect example, we didn't say every hospital in Texas had to shut down. We didn't shut down in the entire economy of Texas, even though that was a really bad disease, right? 50% mortality rate. We didn't do that. Spanish flu, 1918, 675,000 people die in America, 50 million worldwide. It was 25 times more deadly.
How many in America?
675,000.
Okay. And it was, I interrupted you right there. It was 25 times what?
25 times more deadly than what we're dealing with right now. It had a 2.5% case fatality rate. So far, all the data is showing from the other countries, from our country, about a 0.1% case fatality rate with coronavirus. That means 99.9% of the people that get it are not going to die. And most of them aren't even going to know they have it. So no symptoms whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so even at 25 times worse, and by the way, Jim, Spanish flu, man, you're talking kids dying. I mean, that one was spreading among the children. A lot of the fatality was with kids. And so you can imagine people said, we got to do something about this. But even in that situation, the president did nothing. You can't even find a single speech or writing of the president of the United States throughout that Spanish flu, the second wave, all of it, saying anything, even when he caught it himself.
Who was
Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
So even being a progressive that was trying, you know, wanted to have government doing more, even he didn't think of seizing power and having government do things it shouldn't do. State governments did not shut down entire states. The heaviest handed I have found so far, and even then not heavy handed, it was a recommendation. The Alabama governor did a recommendation that local governments do whatever it takes to contain the pandemic, and if they see fit, shut down churches and theaters, and then they did it for 2 weeks. You know, even in Philadelphia and Seattle and San Francisco, where it got really bad. At worst, they closed big public gatherings, but everybody else still went to work. They even, it's funny, you look at their quotes, and they were saying things like, you know, the world must go on. We must charge ahead. They had that attitude of, you don't cower down, you find a way to get through this. You're smart, right? They looked for ways. They wore masks in San Francisco and a few other places, but they did not shut the entire economy down. There was New York and a couple of places where they asked companies, they didn't demand it, but they asked companies to modify their work schedule a little bit so that mass transit was not as heavy in the early morning and in the late afternoon. But nobody shut down economies because we've always had this cost benefit. We always knew the cure could be worse than the disease, and to lock down like we've done now. I mean, Jim, you know this as a pastor, the addictions that people are falling back into, the domestic abuse that's happening right now, the suicides, one study's already said we're looking at 25 to 40,000 suicides as a result of this. It's just foolish. We've professed ourselves to be wise and we've become fools, mm-hmm. and we're hurting more people than we're helping.
Now run through those words of the kind of, again, from a legal standpoint, state government, obviously, the who, when can they do it? What do they have the power to do? For how long can they do it? And what ways can they do it? Kind of walk through those with me.
Sure. The first one is who. So the first one is who has authority to do this, and it's not the feds. It's state and local governments. Real important for everybody, as this thing does turn and people will realize the cure was worse than the disease, let's not forget it was governors and mayors that did this to us, not the president of the United States. Donald Trump did not shut down the country. So that's the who. It's state and local.
In a given state, is it the or a given county, the health officer, as the health officer, do they have declarative powers literally over a mayor or a governor?
It's a little bit different. It is a little bit different throughout the country, but most of them what they do is they give the power to a health official in an emergency to make a quick decision, but then give the mayor or the governor the ability to override them. And so they can either enforce that finding, whatever it was, or that decision to do something and keep it going, or they can override them. Even back in 1918 with Spanish flu, you saw a lot of that where the public health commissioner of that area or that particular city became the decision maker, along with a board and with a council and with a mayor or governor or whatever it might be. And there was unity in making those decisions. So yes, very often that unelected official does have significant power, but it is easily curbed by the elected officials. And one thing we're not seeing right now when it comes to that who, Jim, is we're not seeing legislatures have a voice. To give a governor, to give one person, a mayor or a governor, just one person the ability to make law through an executive order and then enforce that law with no say-so from anybody else, most people know in their gut that's a bad idea. It's anti-American. It's unconstitutional. And already we have legislators that are drafting legislation in these states to say, hey, if this ever happens again, you get 10 days or you get 14 days, and then you've got to come to the legislature. Just like if the president ended up in a military situation, we want him to be empowered to deal with that in the moment, but then he's got to come to Congress within 30 days and explain what's going on. We need that to happen more, and I think that would curb some of these out-of-control executive orders. Because what's happening is if you're a governor and you've made these crazy decisions, you don't want to be held accountable for it. You don't want to admit you're wrong, so you're digging in, you're doubling down, and nobody else has a voice. There's no cooler heads to prevail. And so the reason we like representative government and like checks and balances and separation of powers is you have a chance to check that ego or check that decision, and that's not happening right now with these governors.
Now, you live in a red state. I live in a blue state. Your state's opening up. Mine is really not, for the most part, at this present time. And in fact, in the city of Los Angeles, which is north of us, they just announced that they're locking down for 90 more days, real shocker. What does that reveal, before we go on to more in these what, why, and et cetera, and how long they do it, what does that reveal philosophically, politically, when the blue states are locking down more and red states are loosening? Does that simply mean that just miraculously, the people who have the disease are all in blue states? That's why the governors are doing that? Or is there something else going on?
Definitely something else going on. You know the expression about, tough times reveal character. They don't necessarily make character as much as they reveal what your character is. I think in many ways that's true for us as a nation. Our character is being revealed, and we're seeing cracks in the foundation. We don't have that same love of liberty and free enterprise that we used to. Same thing for what you just said. Governors are having their character revealed right now. If they lean towards government's the solution to everything, we need more government to micromanage and control people, then they are jumping on the opportunity to do that. If they lean towards freedom and liberty and let individuals make their decisions, then they're doing like South Dakota's governor. Kristi Noem, I think, is the model of how this should have been handled. She quotes the Constitution almost every press conference she hasn't tried to do to the whole state what's happening in Rapid City. She's just been smart about how to handle it because her knee-jerk reactions were good. DeSantis in Florida, I mean, even with everybody saying you're anti-science, you don't believe the science, he had a much better, much more measured response. And now Florida has not had the big outbreak everybody thought they were going to have. The numbers are backing up his decisions. So it's been kind of a sliding scale. I have to admit, I'm at odds with my governor. He's kind of been in the middle instead of really on the right. I'm part of a lawsuit against Governor Abbott right now, trying to open up the states because he has, in fact, done this as one person and not brought the legislative body into it. And our Constitution actually says you can't, the governor, no one other than the legislature can suspend law. And you'll find this interesting, Jim. That changed 100 years ago. It used to say in Article 1, Section 28 of our state constitution that only the legislature could suspend the law, comma, or someone that they had given the power to. So they could empower the governor to do it. Well, a governor in 1870 did a quarantine and people didn't like it. And they said there ought to be more voices in this thing. And we literally had a constitutional amendment in Texas to take out the after the comma and go back to only the legislature can suspend law in Texas. So we're actually suing the governor under that part of the Constitution, and hopefully going to open up the rest of the business. He's being real slow right now. I mean, his hand was forced last week because you saw that beautician in Dallas that got jailed.
Yes, yes.
We had peaceful protests. The people did proper civil disobedience. It was peaceful. And as Shelley a result, Luther. it put Shelley Luther, exactly right. It put the pressure on, and the Texas Supreme Court is actually who freed her. and let her out of jail. And then because of all that, the governor said, oh, okay, well, I'm going to lift my order on beauticians and I'm going to ask the police officers to stop jailing people. My challenge to the governor was, hey, it was your order that had 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine in it. It's your fault that this happened. I appreciate that you've had your kumbaya moment all of a sudden. But any governors that are doing these orders, you're the ones that are causing the problem.
Now, your lieutenant governor early on made some public statements that created a furor. Some of the leftists were just rabid with what he said. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I do. Yeah.
Can you cite that he's effectively?
I can't quote him exactly how he said it, but he basically said some things are worth dying for. And his point was, you know, this idea of Cuomo saying all of this is worth it if one life is saved. That is so shallow and so immoral to say that. You know, my parents, my wife's grandmother, who's now got her great-great-grandchild in my grandchild, she's, I forget, 85 or whatever, she has said, I would never want you to lose everything you've built for your business, for you to lose your freedom, to supposedly try to save my life. I would never ask you to do all of that so that I can live for, you know, 4 or 5 more years or whatever God's got for me. That's immoral. It's wrong. And I think that's what Dan Patrick was saying. He was saying, this is wrong to kill an economy that's going to ultimately kill a whole lot more people because of poverty and lack of healthcare and all those things. This is wrong to say that one life is worth that, to not have a cost benefit and not say that all policies have unintended consequences and our leaders need to weigh that. It's just foolish and it's sad.
That's what you alluded to earlier. When Cuomo says that, he doesn't count all the lives that have been destroyed.
That's right.
People who did not get proper medical treatment that needed it. We were hearing of situations where people died who didn't need to. They had situations that could have been reversed if they'd had hospital care, but that was taken away from them. What Patrick has said was basically, I'm turning 70, and if we try to just think of preserving my life, my kids aren't going to have a country. So I'll take my risk. And if I lose my life, I don't want to die. But if I do die, I will have saved the country for my children.
That's right.
That was a shocker when he said that. He had our attention. He was ahead of us when he said that.
And Jim, we make that same decision every time we get in a car. We make that same decision every time we do anything. We assume the risk. We know that, you know, 35,000 people die from car wrecks, but we don't say, well, because there's some, you know, crazy drivers out there that might cross the yellow line, we're going to ban all driving. Remember, a lot of this happened because they saw the spring breakers and they said, it's those crazy kids. They're going to cause the problem. So because of them, we're going to lock you in your home. We're going to shut down everybody. Because I mean, that was just, we don't do that with anything else. I mean, we let fear drive us. And as you know, and have spoken to, you know, we're not supposed to have a spirit of fear, power, love, and a sound mind. We're missing the sound mind part right now. We're not using logic. We're not looking at the data. We're not looking at the law. We're not looking at the history and the Constitution. I'm hoping that people are slowing down a little bit and they're starting to think this through and they're starting to look at the historical precedent and say, never in our history have we done this. I was so disappointed, Jim, to see really the lies. Maybe it was by accident. Maybe people just didn't study the history. But the white papers that a lot of these governors and even the White House were being influenced by, these folks were acting like that the government interventions of 1918 were exactly what we're doing right now. And that is so not true. They did not shut down economies. They did not do statewide orders. It's a very, very different situation. And I wish that we could just have that clarity of thought and look at the cost. You know, those ancestors of ours, they won World War I and defeated Spanish flu at the same time without cowering down, without locking people in their homes. They forewent meeting at churches for a couple of weeks, for a little bit of time. They would have never said you couldn't have a Bible study in your home. You couldn't go visit your relatives. Michigan, you can't even go check on your lake house and see if it's flooded. They wouldn't have arrested pastors like we're seeing right now, or like you're, you know, people in the park playing with their children. I mean, this is nonsense. And honestly, Jim, I think it really comes down to just like we need a strong immune system to not get a virus, and so we take vitamins and other things to do that. we have a weak civics system right now, and we need a boost of civics education because what's happening is we've got a petri dish right now where bad government is flourishing because of our weakened immune system as a nation or our weakened civics knowledge. And so what we need to do is boost that right now. That's why we're doing constitutioncoach.com. We got 1,000 constitution coaches across the country, and they're hosting constitution classes. They're teaching people these things. These answers to who and what and when, we do these little videos at constitutioncoach.com so people can go get educated on that.
Those videos are excellent.
Thank you.
Those are superb. I have a short attention span, I think. And so I don't listen. I just don't listen to long presentations. Man, I got hooked on yours. I listened to one after another, after another, after another. I didn't just listen. I watched it. They were superbly
Thank you,
done.
Man.
You know, we all agree that the first, say March 15th on, for the first month, we were willing to sit tight because nobody knew for sure exactly where this was going or how
That's
to handle
right.
it. And we were sold on the idea, and it was a legitimate idea. Flatten the curve doesn't mean less people get it. It just means instead of it being a peak where the hospitals cannot handle it, it flattens out. So the society gets it, but it's over a longer span of time, we can manage it better. It
That's
wasn't
right.
that nobody gets sick, because now, after all, it does create an immunity, healthy ones among us. And for those, if we know what we know now, by week five, it was obvious that something was wrong. Week six, people started losing trust in their government.
Yep.
Because by that time, we had learned it's unbelievably contagious. It got much further than we realized. 21% of New Yorkers that had it and didn't even know it. Way more. You know? And then 94% of those in the hospital had the underlying conditions. 50% of those who are dying are in nursing homes. And so now we begin to know what the situation was. So if we just, at that point, the governors that were wise pivoted and says, let's quarantine the people with the underlying conditions. Because of my age, I'd be in that one of those categories. And I wouldn't object to that. If that's
right.
the wise thing to do, I'd say yes. When they held everybody down coercively, you go in the mask, you don't go out with a mask. I wear a mask all the time. But coercively on the mask, when there's some dispute, if there's not some disadvantages,
right.
even in that potentially. And that's what gets objected. So we know they had a legal authority that first stretch. But once we get to about week five or six in this, there seems to be an abuse of authority. Keep walking us through
how long
this go would be obviously a key question, and what can be done legally. So go ahead.
And Jim, I'm like you. It's like, hey, I'm willing to sacrifice. I mean, we sequestered our home, not quarantine, not isolation. Sequester is your own decision, right? You're doing it on your own authority.
Yeah.
And we chose to stay because of, you know, like I said, my wife's grandmother and you know, I got a daughter-in-law with an immune issue. So autoimmune issue. So we wanted to be careful, right? And that makes sense. Let Americans make that decision. And we took a huge financial hit to do that because we make our money traveling and speaking and, you know, all of those things. So we made that decision on our own, and we should have let Americans do that. But to your question, you know, and I said, if you watch those videos in order, you can tell in that first couple of videos, I said, hey, this is their moment. This is their chance. They're at the apex of their power. And statutorily, we've given them this opportunity. And they're convinced that this is literally going to wipe out our health system in America and going to kill 2.5 million people. So they're exercising that power. So let's have some public trust and let's give them the chance to see if they're right or not. And then 2 weeks later, I'm making videos going, okay, we gave them their chance. We gave them an inch. They've taken the mile. Now, you know, we've got to start doing something about it. And so that's really what you're asking is then what do we do at that point when they won't give up the power, even though the data and the science is saying there's no longer a compelling interest? You know, I think it's going to take a lot of lawsuits. Honestly, I think Alliance Defending Freedom and Liberty Council and First Liberty and Pacific Justice and all these groups, I think they're doing yeoman's work right now, and they're suing governors. I think Matt Staver at Liberty Council's got, I don't know how many, like 5 different suits against governors right now. We've got churches that are being defended. There's already been a ton of victories. A lot of these judges have said right off the, in fact, I love one of them. He says, this is the very definition of tyranny. It's the very definition of tyranny to tell people to stay in their homes, that they cannot even come out of their home unless they are essential based on what this one person in the state says. Most of these courts have said this is completely unconstitutional to tell churches they cannot meet when you're letting Home Depot and Walmart and others come together. Have some faith in these pastors who love their flocks to be smart about how they open their churches. Have some faith in these businesses who want their customers to come in, and they don't want to put them in danger. And so they're taking measures. if our post offices, if Amazon, if all these companies that we're letting stay open can be smart and make rational decisions about this, why can't we trust the rest of America to do that? Are some people going to mess up? Of course, that's human nature. That's part of freedom. And so I think at this point, we're at a point where civil disobedience is actually necessary, but it's got to be peaceful. And Jim, you were so spot on. In fact, we had you on Wall Builders Live to talk about it. I loved your article about having a theology of protest. That has influenced a lot of what I've been saying on shows. And it, checking your heart, like you said, I so appreciated that, because I can get righteously angry. You know, I mean, I know we can be angry and sin not, and there's been times where I got angry and sinned. Okay. So, I really appreciated how you put that out. And I've been trying to spread that word to folks. The worst thing people can do, I think, is violence in these protests, or coming across hateful. If you're screaming at police officers, you're not helping. If you're showing up with your AR slung over your chest, you're not helping. You're feeding the narrative, and you're actually going to allow, you're going to encourage these dictators, and I'm calling them emperors, and you're going to encourage them to crack down harder. So just be smart, be wise as serpents, be exercise judgment. And like you said in your article, I encourage everybody to read that. Have a good theology of protest before you step up, and realize you may be arrested. You may be fined. You may lose the license for your restaurant or whatever it might be. And hopefully enough people are going to be willing to stand up and do that in a peaceable, wise way that will turn the tide on this thing. But you can't go out there hateful. That's, you know, Martin Luther King was right. You don't drive out hate with hate. You got to have love, and just pretend you're signing that deal with he and Reverend Shuttlesworth, that if you're going to march with them in Birmingham, you have to sign that piece of paper that says, I'll think like Christ. I'll have love in my heart. I'll speak like Christ. If you act like that when you go into these protests, we're going to win this thing.
We have a situation here on the West Coast right now. You and I are taping this before May 31, and May 31 is Pentecost Sunday. And a group of pastors have decided, I've pastored for decades, many decades, but I'm not pastoring a church now because I'm full-time in our ministry in D.C. and in New York City and such. But they are saying that they're going to open on Pentecost Sunday. And they petitioned and asked the governor. They want 3,000 signatures on there representing the 3,000 who came to Christ on Pentecost Sunday.
I love that. Oh, it's a great idea.
So hundreds of churches presumably are going to open on that day. Some have attempted to open before that. Play out the scenario for me. Gavin Newsom could be smart and say, okay, I discriminated when I said schools can open before churches in phase two. I also violated probably the First Amendment. So I'll back away. Gavin could be smart on that, but I'm not sure that he's going to be.
Right.
So what is the, there's obviously a flurry of lawsuits. Is it conceivable? I hate to even say this. He could call out National Guard and block churches on that day.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's conceivable. I think he's smart enough about the optics that he wouldn't do that. And you know, it's kind of like I keep going back to the civil rights movement because I always draw the analogy between Malcolm X and MLK, that Malcolm X was kind of violent and hateful and wasn't very effective, whereas MLK was peaceful and did it different and changed the world. And when those kids were arrested in Birmingham in those marches and the dogs came out and the fire hoses and all that got on the news, that's what changed the heart of America on that issue. And that may happen here. You know, I mean, the images of pastors being arrested, the images of, you know, churches, that guy in Mississippi, when, you know, it was so, I mean, he was video. So good when he got his phone out and he said, when I was a drug dealer, there were never this many cops around. Now I'm a pastor. Yes. And came to the Lord. Now I'm a pastor. We got this little bitty church and every cop in town was there. I mean, they surrounded the church. And it wasn't even going to be an in-person service. It was.
They were sitting in their cars with the windows up.
And drive-in service.
He kept saying, as a black pastor, and he handled it just perfectly at his church. He said, "This is America. This is America. Look at this. This is America."
Yeah.
And he kept playing it. I was spellbound as I watched.
I was moved by it. I'm telling you, it was powerful. And our mutual friend Kelly Shackelford represented him and did such a great job and got that overturned. And of course we saw in Kentucky where they were taking down the license plate by order of the governor. We are going to track you and we are going to make you quarantine and take your temperature every day and call this number. All of this with zero evidence that anybody in that church had the virus or came in contact with the virus. It's off the charts. I told Matt Staver, who's representing that church, I said, you know, are they handing out the yellow badge? Are we back to the 1930s? Oh, you're a Christian, so you get the yellow badge the way the Jews did in the 1930s. Mm. I know that sounds like hyperbole and exaggeration, but Jim, it's that scary. It's that bad. So I think you do have to be prepared for a Gavin Newsom and that crowd to try to crack down even further. And I think churches need to have legal counsel. I think they need to be prepared. But I think they should be opening up. And you know, there's one pastor that's got a great video out there where he's saying, you know, Jesus was the lamb and he's also the lion. And pastors need to kind of tap into that lion part a little bit right now and be bold and stand up and say, we're no longer going to forsake the gathering together. We've gotten to a point where it's literally infringing upon on exercising your faith. When you can't take communion with your pastor in your church, when you can't come together and have a Bible study in your home, when you can't gather together for this long, you're no question violating the exercise of that religion. And then when you're allowing other people to gather and meet for other purposes while shutting that down, it's a clear violation of the Constitution. And that's why we're winning those lawsuits.
Rick Green, I want to thank you. And I want to encourage everybody to go to those videos. What's the website for
the ConstitutionCoach.com is the website. And we're okay. In fact, we just launched yesterday this Know Your Rights campaign, because you cannot properly defend and assert your rights if you don't know them. And to have that immune boost of civics, if you will, so that Americans can know their rights and then defend them, we're trying to educate as many people as possible. And I would challenge folks, take the Constitution class, you know, do exactly what Jim did and go watch those videos and then take a Constitution class with us. We're doing them weekly. We got people hosting them, and then maybe host one, become a Constitution coach yourself and host our biblical citizenship classes in your church and with your fellow believers.
ConstitutionCoach.com. And yes, you'll see, he alluded to the fact that as you start the videos, it was early on in the coronavirus event. And he makes the case rather compellingly that they do have the authority to do what they're doing. The question mark now has been pressed way beyond what is rational.
Yeah.
So
only to clarify, Jim, when we say they have the authority to do what they're doing, it's what they were doing at that time, which was simply asking for public gatherings to be less than 50 at the time I made that first video, and then it became 10. And then when the governor, when Newsom, your governor, you should be so proud, when he did the first statewide stay-at-home order, that was when I came unhinged and said, no, this is going way too far now. So that, I would say, they've never had the constitutional authority to do.
Also, patriotacademy.com?
Com. Yes, sir, .com.
And get your kids, 16 to 25, into Patriot. And what's the favorite book you'd like to tell us about that they ought to look on their website? The favorite book of all you've ever written.
Oh, wow. Well, Freedom's Frame is a great start because it uses the Declaration and breaks down the founding principles of America. Zig Ziglar did the foreword for me. So that's a great place to start. It's a quick read, and it'll give you a really good foundation on those things. And I will say for Patriot Academy, those over 25, we do have a Patriot Academy for you. It's a little different. We have a military Patriot Academy. I want to see more military veterans running for office and serving. So we're training them through Patriot Academy as well. So there's something for everybody if you go to patriotacademy.com.
I'm over 25, so you have something for me.
Come on. Come on, brother. Come on. We want you.
Rick, what a joy to be with
I'll
you.
I'll do my best, Uncle Sam. We need you. I want you. That's what.
Oh, thanks for being with us today. Loved having you on. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to connecting. We got to connect again while he's podcast, okay?
Hey, you bet, brother. I'd be glad to anyway. Thanks for letting me call you Jim. I know it's Dr. Garlow, but you're a close friend, and I love you, man. I appreciate what you do, and I love how you're influencing pastors and people all over the country right now. So keep up the great work.
Thank you. Bless you. Love you, brother. And thank you for being with us on this Well-Versed podcast.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please read the show notes for additional details if you would like a copy of the book or resources mentioned. Remember that Well-Versed is a 501c3 tax-deductible nonprofit organization. We rely on your support and partnership.
Thank you for listening to the Well-Versed podcast. For more information, please go to www.wellversedworld.org.